at 1:14. And first, before we get to item one, the Chief Operating Officer's report, I'm going to turn it over to our Deputy CEO, Paul Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have some more good news about the positive good news. About the positive impact of our operations team in the community they serve. This time, an operations instructor, Transit Operations Supervisor Edward Cunningham, has been selected by the NAACP Youth Council as a recipient of its prestigious 2011 Man of Valor Award. The Youth Council is a mentoring program where community leaders mentor young people ages 8 to 13 to strive for achievement through education and integrity. The director there, Mary Lean Wilson, has told us that Mr. Cunningham regularly volunteers his time to mentor these young people and share his achievement in the workplace and in the community. He's quite an excellent photographer, I'm told, and has become the official photographer for the group. So he's not only a role model, he's one of the most popular and inspiring participants in the success of these aspiring young people. TOS Cunningham has been with us for 30 years. There's his picture. He's a former bus operator who moved to Central Instruction about 5 years ago to train other bus operators. I understand, in fact, I'm sure he's good at his job because when he trains new operators, they learn more than the mechanics of operating the bus. They learn by example his brand of professionalism, efficient and courteous customer service, and integrity on and off the job. The NAACP will present this award later this month at an awards luncheon. Incidentally, Mr. Cunningham is in good company. Previous recipients have included Tavis Smiley, Councilman Bernard Parks, Reverend Cecil Murray, retired U.S. Postmaster James Smith, and newsman Mark Brown, and the list goes on and on. I'd like to call on Hector Guerrero, the director of our Central Instruction, and he will introduce TOS Edward Cunningham.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and directors, thank you for the opportunity to present to Transit Operations Supervisor Instructor Edward Cunningham, recognize him for his contributions to the community, and acknowledge the award he will be receiving from the NAACP as a man of valor. Mr. Cunningham exemplifies the values of integrity and commitment, whether serving as a role model, mentoring young people, or bus operator trainees. I proudly present to the board Instructor Edward Cunningham and thank him for his dedication to serving those in need of guidance.
Cunningham, would you like to say a few words? It's a tremendous honor you've received, and we congratulate you, but the microphone is yours.
Thank you very much, board, committee. I want to thank everybody for recognizing me at this time. I didn't see it coming, so I'm really choked up, not only by receiving this award from MTA, which is my family, but the community in which I serve. You know, I do it because I want to. I didn't go at it to receive accolades or pats on the back. You know, you see a need and you tend to it. You don't let it just fester. You know, you take care of it. And that's what I tend to do. So I just say thank you one more time. I want to thank my wife for coming. She came today.
Absolutely.
And also, I went to high school with that young man sitting right there. He's a good friend of mine, so you know we're excelling.
Congratulations.
Ed. Thank you, sir.
Congratulations, well deserved, and thanks for your continuing leadership.
Let's go out and get a picture.
Okay.
Right there, break up those hot heads, man. No, good. Right here. There you go. Much better now. Thank you. Congratulations to you again.
Thank you.
Called back.
Yeah.
You called back. You had manual?
Yep.
73.
Oh, 73.
Youngsters.
Pat Chambers.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Congratulations. Yeah. Keep him in line.
Great job.
Okay.
Mr. Mitchell. This is my wife. You can over have lunch and talk to us and talk back at
us. Can we have a meeting at 3?
Oh, sure. Sure.
Are we going to hold this down a little bit?
Are we going to get a glare on the question?
Okay, let's, in a moment we're going to move to the Transit Operations Report with Mr. Lonnie Mitchell, our COO.
Good afternoon. First slide, please. Customer complaints increased to 2.71 complaints per 1,000 warnings, a 19% increase over February. Most of the complaints, the increase were in the categories of no-shows, pass-ups, operator discourtesy, and accidents. This displays something that we've reported on for some time, the operator assignment ratio. In March, it was below the target at 1.18. As we speak today, it's at 1.172. We're engaged in executing a plan to increase throughput, new hires through OCI, to bring this to 1.20 by the end of September. Okay. As part of the plan I just referred to, we're including rail in this also, and we're going to dial back the rail operator assignment ratio also to be at 1.20. We're on target with the budget for fare revenues. March year-to-date actuals are slightly more than the year-to-date budget. March average weekday boardings increased, representing about a 3% increase over February. However, a slight decrease year over year by 1.15%. March Orange Line average weekday boardings increased by 2.7%. And I'd make the note that next month we will be combining this chart with the direct and contracted bus boardings to provide a system-wide view of boardings. Average weekday boardings for total rail boardings decreased slightly by 1.4% from February, about a 3% year-over-year decrease. We believe the weather during March had a bearing on this, typically influencing some riders to choose other modes of transportation. Okay. This has been one of our good news stories for quite a while now. For the month of March, on-time performance increased slightly to just short of 76%, a year-over-year increase of just short of 3%. The percentage of buses running early or hot is 4.31%, down from what was clearly an unacceptable rate 15 to 18 months ago. But the second chart there shows the earlies. This provides a bit of a historical perspective on what I was just speaking about. We've mentioned several times performance is improving, and this displays the steady increase since FY 2006. We've had this slide in the presentation in the last 3 or 4 months. I'd make the note that this is material condition as well as cleanliness. Overall, we're over the target. And for those divisions that are below the target, we're working with them to revisit their cleaning plans with a focus on the specific parts of the 19 area that we use in criteria in assigning these scores. Bus accidents per 100,000 hub miles decreased slightly this month to 3.3%. We're still higher than FY 2010, but in better shape than we had been in prior years. Just wanted to give you a little more information. I don't think we've showed this one before. This provides a little bit of perspective on some of the tools available to staff. In this case, looking at the monthly accident analysis. This provides opportunities for drill down to look at specific criteria such as side swipes, hit by vehicle, and so on. And then we can further narrow the search by looking at specific divisions in specific months. We think there's a real good tool for management to review as we assess how we're doing on accidents.
Can I ask, based on this data, I presume now that we have it, we're still developing plans on how to analyze it, but looking at particular routes to see if there's safety issues involved in that route or...
And crossings. Yes, sir.
Okay, very good.
On the fleet reliability, mean miles between mechanical failures decreased 5% from February. This is, however, an 8% year-over-year increase. And year-to-date, for the year, we've increased 9% from the experience in FY09. In this case, we had an increased number of engine-related road calls, and we're implementing an engine road call reduction plan that involves increased training, strengthening of inspections, and a better utilization of our resources.
Do we have a summer peaking issue here with cooling-related roll calls? You know, it looked like July to October, the miles was down. Is that a summer issue?
We've had that experience previously. I don't have in front of me the...
There are some cyclical issues that come up. We're trying to address those proactively so that we do not run into these kinds of issues as the summer comes on board and the hot summer months approach us.
This one we have not, to my knowledge, shown before. A little bit of drill down behind that summary information we just spoke about that looks at roll calls by bus series and system. Again, providing an opportunity for better management review to ensure that we're focusing efforts where they need to be focused. This is a good news story. In the time I've been sitting in this chair, we haven't talked a lot about accessible service. The headline this is basically boardings are up substantially from FY06 while the complaints are down. The CEO has given all of us a challenge to take a look at our current workforce and view it in terms of future expectations. And operations is part of a much larger group effort that's being done to look at key leadership positions that are close to retirement and ensure we have some kind of plan in place to address what I'll call the grain of the workforce. We have a slightly different problem than some of the other SBUs. There's no degree in transit operations. We've got to develop the leaders internally. And so we're working with development and training to put in place a program to help us develop those future leaders we need internally. This one speaks to the same issue, basically talking about aligning this with a business strategy, identifying gaps between the future, the current and future workforce, and ensuring that we have qualified potential successors so that it doesn't become a one-person competition. Also working on a Metro University, given that there is no real external university program to assess our needs, to provide training in the core technical areas focused on instruction, control vehicle operations, and dispatch and markup. We recognize that we have a fairly significant backlog on deferred maintenance, and this is just to make the point that we understand that we've got issues in bus and rail as well as facilities, and the first two there are related on the midlifes and the engine repower. Some of the older buses will just get an engine repower, others will get a repower as well as midlife overhaul. We have similar issues on the Blue Line and the subway. I think we've mentioned a couple times previously that we do a pretty good job of building facilities, but we've not adequately resourced them over the years, and we've put in place some programs to start attacking what's happened to our rail stations. And so we're looking at and assuring that we at least have a minimum of deep cleaning in every station every 2 years. We're working on decreasing the painting cycle on buses from 6 down to 4 years, and we recognize we've got some division roof issues that we have to address, and those will be cranked into the program also. The recent heightened focus on security awareness and response times has brought some lessons for us that we'll be working for over the next several months. We've got communications systems issues, ensuring we have the appropriate watch standards trained on what we have available, ensuring seamless sharing of that information that the systems allow us to communicate, developing an SOP that's understood by all. Basically, the intent is train the way we fight and fight the way we train. And then also the third part of this is a pre-planned watch bill. When we went through a 0600 to 10 p.m. Watch bill here at the headquarters, we had to scramble to work on a watch bill. We're going to have that in place all the time from now on. And that's already been done. Subject to any questions, that's end of my presentation.
Appreciate the presentation. We do have a request from the public to address this item, so I'll call them forward, and then we'll see if there's a board discussion as well. John Walsh.
You know, we do have a ticking time bomb planted by the board on rail, and that is deferred maintenance, and also on the buses. We hear it, deferred maintenance. You're waiting for an accident. That's what you're waiting for. Or for a story from the LA Times, which I'm working on, or a story from the New York Times, which I'm working on. New York Times is the new editor here, the bureau chief, has been very, very interested in LA, okay? So, and I want rail boardings? Wait a second, common sense. It's a no-brainer. Gas prices go up, ridership goes up on rail. March over March, 155,000 a year ago, March 10th on the red line, 144,000. You're going down 6%. What is happening? No one wants to ride it. It's filthy. It's not that dangerous because the sheriffs do a good job. It takes too long. No one's using it. They don't care how much it takes to gas is. Nobody's using the red line.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Questions, Director Wilson.
Yeah, Mr. Mitchell, can you tell us whether your department has been working with the folks from APTA regarding some type of a educational program so that we can replace those who are attritioning out?
We have a continuing relationship with APTA on a number of committees. That's not one I personally am aware that we have lots of contact on. We'll make sure that's part of the discussion.
To answer your question in part is we have, in fact, tried to put people on committees to grow them into leadership positions. I myself have attended at least one of those sessions to try to grow more in the areas and get broader knowledge of transportation issues.
So what do we have a plan for the folks that are going to be retiring out to replace?
We're in the process of developing that plan.
Yes. In fact, we have been meeting with all of the executive leaders of the agency. We have identified for them areas in each of their departments where there is potential for within the next retirements in key positions within the next 5 to 10 years. We have several different types of training programs going forward. And one that you might be interested in, which Mr. Leahy was the father of, which we have are promoting at this time, is where it's an exchange program where several of Lonnie's staff people, 8 to 10, will go to two other transit properties and exchange those people from those transit properties will come here. And we have developed a curriculum for them, which goes into a level of detail on the intricacies of transit operations management. So it sort of gets at that issue that you raised with APTA. Are we teaching about transit operations in general? How do other properties do it? What are the important elements? And so we are now planning to start that exchange program with Denver, and that will be in August. San Diego in January, and then everyone will be coming to Los Angeles next May, and we'll write up a report and keep you advised of that program.
Excellent. Questions by other directors? Let's proceed to the second item then, which is, and we thank Mr. Mitchell, the second item is a report on Los Angeles Metro Protective Services.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on Commander Pat Jordan of the Transit Services Bureau of the LA County Sheriff's Department, who is the unified commander for the LA Metro Protective Services, which includes not only the Sheriff's Transit Services Bureau, but our own Metro Transit Security. Pat?
All right. Thank you, sir, and good afternoon. You know, when I became the Chief of Transit Police and Security in October, I realized that we have used the same staffing model or strategies to police the system for probably about 10 years, and that those strategies were not serving our needs. So I asked my staff to write a strategic plan, which we finalized, but a big key part of that strategic plan is intelligence-led policing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about intelligence-led policing today and what it means for us and what it will mean for Metro. Where we were at in July when we started transitioning as we learned more about intelligence policing and the benefit of it, and where we hope to go to. So here are our goals that we want to achieve, because you need to be clear on where you're going. And I got public safety up there as number one, but really that's broader than public safety. That's the public perception of safety. You really do have a safe transit system. But with quality of life issues, people don't always feel safe. So we really got to focus our effort on that and look at strategies to succeed at that. Certainly the quality of life issues we want to address. Visibility and accountability is key towards the perception of public safety. And of course, we always have to focus on part one crime, because one major crime could give us a black eye. Next slide. Intelligence-led policing is a business model and a management philosophy where data analysis and crime intelligence is pivotal to the decision-making and framework that facilitates basically how we do our job. By using these strategies, we're able to focus more on where the problem is at, when it's happening at, but more importantly, given in constrained budget times, use our resources more efficiently and more effectively. Next slide. To do that, the first thing you got to do is you got to entering into a planning phase on how you're going to implement intelligence-led policing. So you need to, what direction you want to go, what are your priorities? You need to start collecting the information, collecting the data, process that information, and that means where crime is happening at, where your quality of life is happening at. What are some of the barriers to being successful at solving some of the crime problems? You collate that information, you analyze it, and you come up with a plan on how you're going to deal with it. Then you push it out to your team to implement. And let me give you one example, and I'll talk a little bit about it a little bit later, but one example is we had a lot of problem with school trippers, and deferring them to the criminal system wasn't working for us. So about a year ago, we started talking to the school district, and we finalized a plan today where they would we would defer them from the criminal process. These are juveniles going to court on our school tripper buses to the school disciplinary process. We think that that might have a stronger impact on the student to behave when they're on the buses, and it builds a partnership with LAUSD. So this is one of those transitional projects as we move from what we used to do to where we want to go to be more successful in mitigating crime and disorder on our system. So once you push this information out, then you want to reevaluate whether it's working. So in this case, as we kick this off with LAUSD, we want to see if our school tripper problems have gone down and if it's had a positive impact on the students' behavior on our buses. Next slide. So when you implement the process, obviously once we've done our research, which we've already done, we've educated our management team over the last several months on what this means. We've begun our planning process and how we want to do this, and we're involved in our capacity building. Capacity building is we had to completely change how our crime analysis folks looked at crime. Or looked at disorder and crime on our system and how they gathered information and the reports that they gave us so that we could make decisions. And then we formulated a committee to bring everybody together to develop policy based on what we've learned from the information. And one example of that we know where our crime occurs at as it relates to reporting districts, train stations, but we really don't know where it occurs at a train station. So we refined our data collection. Does it happen at the bus turnaround near the train station? Does it happen at the TVMs? Is it happening at the entrance? So that we can refine where it's, because some of these train stations are big, so we really need to get more specific on where it's happening so that we can give that information to our team and try and reduce the disorder. So once we get that information, we then implement our program. And for us, we're kicking off intelligence-led policing June 1st, which means we got a big education project with our team. And then, of course, once you do that, you develop measurement structures to see if it's working and make sure everybody's aware of what we're counting. Next slide. You know, here are some of the transitional programs that we're working that rely on more on intelligence-led policing and are moving in a different direction. You know, the quarterly fare audits, yeah, they audit what we're doing for fares, but they also give us an idea of where disorder's happening at. So we can use that information, the fare ops and the quarterly audits, to find out where we need to direct our resources. And one of the partnerships that we've developed to do this is with USC. They have a center for risk and an economic analysis of terrorism events. So we're kind of piggybacking some of the research that's occurring with terrorism and trying to use that data to modify how we do our own policing, and USC has agreed to partner with us on that. Next slide. I talked a little bit about this already. It's really identifying where things are happening at so that we can specifically target a particular problem. So, for example, peddlers are not really happening at the stations, it's happening on the trains, because once they get on the train and realize there's not a deputy there, they can sell their wares. Well, we want to stop that, so we need to identify exactly where they're happening at so that we can target it, if it's the blue line or the green line, and what times of day, and those types of things. But we have to capture that data to be more efficient in how we deploy our resources. Next slide. I talked a little bit about this program. We're really excited about this, but it is the key thing about when you have diminishing resources is to look at who your natural partners are to solve your problems and bring them on board. The school district hasn't always been excited about working with us, but they are now because we worked out an arrangement on how we're going to work together and be more efficient and how we can impact some of the problems that they have. Next slide. And in this case, you guys have heard me talk about tagging before. Taggers is a database that allows us to collect information so we can be more efficient in what we do. Now, the partnership with LAUSD that they're really excited about, this piece, is we told them that we would train their folks on how to do graffiti investigations and that we would partner with them in identifying the damage on their system that is consistent with the same damage on our system, combine our cases, and move with prosecution together. So we're going to have a task force of LAUSD police officers this summer when school's on hiatus, and that's when we'll train them. So you'll see some LAUSD folks on the train systems and on the buses, but we'll also be on the campuses working with them. And hopefully with this partnership, we can be more effective at focusing on graffiti. We did do a graffiti summit. We had 250 police officers from around the country and the region attend, and we taught them how we do graffiti and how we focus on them, the importance of partnering in the databases so that all of us can streamline the work that we're doing as it relates to graffiti. And also we taught them how some of the cutting edge approaches to dealing with graffiti, and that deals with the social work or social websites on the internet and how we're using those to effectively investigate crimes. It was very well received. Next slide. So I want to just take a look at where we were at July 1 with staffing models. Go ahead. And you can see we're a little light on the blue line and green line. This was right after we took some staffing reductions. And it also prompted me that, you know, changing how we do our job isn't just because it's stale and maybe we need to move, but the realities of today's constrained budgets, we need to change how we operate. So this is the early morning shift. And I'll talk about some changes that we did there a little bit later, but this is the staffing that we faced on July 1, and it's the basic staffing that we move forward with, but we've changed how we operate, which I'll talk about a little later. Next slide. And here's the day shift, as you see here. We were a little light on the blue line and green line. After those staffing reductions, we have redeployed some folks, so this isn't 100% accurate. And I'll talk about those redeployments in a second. Next slide. This is the PM shift, but what you have there, again, some of the similar problems that you have on day shift for the blue line and green line as well. And next slide. Okay, keep going to the next one. Okay, here are some of the redeployments. And again, these are transitional redeployments until we get our intelligence-led policing on board and we implement some of the key aspects of our strategic plan. That will be a roadmap for us for the next few years. And the first one is, the early morning shift, they used to be split up bus versus rail. What we did is we sectorized those folks. Service on the rail stops after a certain hour, and then you have OWL service. So we wanted to be more effective in how we used our rail guys on bus. So while the rail is still operating, those folks are targeted to the rail systems, and then once it's over with, they shift over to the bus side. And now they are sectorized in that because we really lean on early morning shift, if there is a bus call near a rail station where they're at, it's their handle. They go to it. And this has provided us greater accountability and greater visibility, and we're getting more rides on the OWL service operations at night, which makes the bus operators happy. So we've already done that, and we tweaked it, and it's working very well for us. The second one is started with a redeployment back in October. We saw an uptick in robberies on the blue line and green line, and so we started focusing more of our efforts on the green line and blue line. We deployed some resources from North and special operations teams to focus on the blue line and green line, and we did get a decrease in robberies, but we still have a problem with quality of life issues, and the biggest problems we have are panhandlers and vendors. So we're focusing on that issues, and we're using plainclothes operators, plainclothes deputies, to focus on that particular problem. And in the last several months, we've made over 100 arrests for vendors and several hundred citations for vendors. It's still a chronic problem, but we are focused on it. We've developed a habitual vendor violators list, and that goes out to the deputies. And those folks that are responsible for several arrests, we now hold them. They don't just get a citation and go to court. They get held on a watch commander's hold, and they stay in jail for the night or sometimes the weekend. So that's part of intelligence-led policing. You're realizing you're not having a problem. You're trying to identify what the problem is, and you're using strategies to have greater impact.
Now, will the Transit Accord effort that we're setting up be able to help with some of those types of issues?
I think it might. Some of the quality of life issues, we don't really have penal code sections on. And so the Transit Accord, with the ability to cite them, may give us some teeth in handling those quality of life issues that are not at this point criminal.
Okay.
So the other redeployment is we've targeted the deputies and security assistants on kind of a matrix based on where the crimes are happening. So even though they might be responsible for certain areas, if one particular train station has a problem or one particular line might have a problem, we'll focus them more in that area. So we're already starting to do a little bit of intelligence-led policing with this redeployment. And hopefully when we kick off in June, we'll pick up steam on how we do that stuff. And that gives us increased visibility and increased accountability. Redeployments of canine. You know, the problem we have with canine is canines have a huge training burden. 50% of their time is training, and so we had them set up so that they were spaced out around the system to respond to suspicious package. But very much like what's going on with the LA City firefighters, they were responding to those calls, but we weren't getting the second half out of what we wanted with the canines, and that was visibility. So we put the guys on a matrix. We looked at where the calls for service were happening. We put them on those matrix based on those calls for service to get greater visibility out of the folks, but also so that to be closer to where the problems are happening at. And that redeployment occurred about 3 months ago, and it actually proved to be pretty effective during this latest Osama bin Laden threat. The bus sectors, the redeployment of motors. What we did is we looked at their schedule and we decided we wanted to expand the motors that work downtown to assist with calls for service in that downtown corridor. That's where we get most of our calls for service, both the north end of the blue line, the red line, and the business sector for buses. They're very effective at getting around. So one of the ways to increase visibility is you get your footbeat units out of the car and on the platforms. They don't have to worry about responding to the calls. You use your motors to respond to those calls. But we had to flatten out their schedules so that we can be a little more efficient in how they do, and so that we can spread them around a little bit more. So we're just implementing that now, and we're changing those schedules right now. So we're looking forward to some positive changes there. The redeployment of SPU. This is right now, until we get this fully up and running, we had to scale back our approach on graffiti to focus on the quality of life issues on the blue line and green line, and also to implement some of the changes we want to make on the blue line and green line. So they've been redeployed for about a month. We were already making a lot of arrests for quality of life stuff, and that has ramped up since those guys have gotten involved. Next slide. Here are the tactics and functions, and you know, I won't go through all of these, but this is basically what some of the stuff we've used in the past. However, we want to, it's going to be refined as to where they should be based on the intelligence-led policing. And you can see the first three tactics that we have there: mobile random foot patrols, the train patrols, and the fixed posts. Those are designed to deal with our core problem, and that is perception of safety. So by using these strategies, that's really what we're targeting. And you see that visibility, it equals perception of safety. So that's our number one issue that we're dealing with on all those. And it does give us the ability to deal with all the other stuff. So it also gives us deterrence. We get to be ambassadors with the public, enforcement, obviously, when they're there. We can do fair ops with those guys, and a lot of those other things on the list. The anti-crime ones, you know, we're going to do deployments based on and use plainclothes or specialized uniform patrols to target particular types of crimes, and hope to get the functions are obviously enforcement, detection, a lot of the same stuff you see at the SOP one, but it's a little different because we're not focusing specifically on perception safety. We're focusing on getting the guys that are committing the crimes off the system. The area support cars, we're going to have to bring some of those folks back. You know, by losing those cars in the past, we have to figure out a way to support the deputies who are on fixed posts. But those folks can be used in a targeted way when we're doing operations. So even though they may be in a car, they would be pulled out of the car when we're doing specialized operations based on what the intelligence that we're gathering is telling us. Next slide. Talked a little bit about this. I'll just talk about a couple of these things because they're kind of relevant right now. We want to move towards using the deputies and the security systems more in a partnership. In the past, we deployed the deputies and two-man teams and security assistants and two-person teams. We want to maybe change that up and get a more collaborative effort with those folks, and look to get a little better accountability and productivity out of everybody in the team. The rapid response of canines and TIU, as we've seen since Osama bin Laden was killed, we had a 500% increase in responses to unattended packages and suspicious packages. So we want to look at what we're doing. It was very effective, but I want to make sure that we have that same level of rapid response 24/7 as we deal with stuff. We had a couple of delays, and I'm hoping that as we look at that and tweak that, that we can minimize that as much as possible. The other area is assignment area responsibility and beat management. As we push out this information, we'll have expectations of the sergeants, the team leaders, and the lieutenants that they will design a beat plan based on the intelligence that we're giving them to focus on the problems, and that's what we'll be measuring. As we give them the issues, we want them to resolve the problems. Next slide. Here's what we want to get. Obviously, enhanced divisibility, enhanced accountability and supervision, ownership of areas of responsibility, enhanced quality of life for the obviously for the patrons. Increased perception of safety, that's key. You know, more people feel safe, more people ride. We always want to focus on decreasing Part 1 crimes, and of course right now we really need to deal with our vendor and peddler disorder that's occurring on the blue line and green line. Next slide. Okay, these are conclusions. Basically, you know, Metro is growing, and we got to develop new strategies to deal with that growth. We need to be dynamic in how we do our deployments. And we need to do that through improved resource utilization by intelligence-led policing. So we're embracing this new development philosophy, and we are pushing it out and training everybody over the next couple of months on how they need to act based on this new philosophy. Any questions?
Yeah, I appreciate the report, Commander. I'll ask the committee if they have any questions. And actually, I'm going to ask our Deputy CEO to make some comments.
Yes, I think today's report is extraordinarily important because it represents a transitional period in Metro Protective Services, where we're moving to focus more on the visibility and the perception of safety on our system at the same time as we are moving to do an increasingly good job on fare enforcement. So we'll be back in the next couple of months with some more information about the redeployments and the intelligence-led policing that the chief has talked about. And I ask for the committee's indulgence and involvement in that process as we go through.
Well, I appreciate that, and we'll want some updates as well in terms of the fare inspections and how those are going. Questions by members of the committee?
I just simply want to say that the thoroughness of the report is important, because often enough there may be the impression that the matter of public safety is not attended to with the level of care required. So I just want to acknowledge the fact that the detail and the relative simplicity, although it was lengthy, is important, so that the opportunity is made available to at least have some appreciation for the challenges and the scope, the extent of what is being done to make operations safer, more friendly, and secure for passengers. It does not suggest that more can't be done. It does suggest that a lot is being done. And I just want to acknowledge that.
Thank you, sir.
Director Wilson.
Commander Jordan, a very good report. I have a couple questions I'd like to ask you to help me out with. One of them has to do with emergency evacuation, and do you have a plan, and are you working with our security officers in that plan and with the mutual aid departments in the region in the event that we have a natural disaster, earthquake, or tsunami, or terrorist act?
Yeah, Metro has a variety of plans to deal with problems, and so does the Sheriff's Department, and they work collaboratively to deal with a lot of similar problems. You know, once a natural disaster happens, there'll be an assessment done by Metro and the Sheriff's Department on its infrastructure. And many of the disasters that you mentioned, Metro probably will come out of them fine, and Metro then gets looked at as a resource. So first you take a look at, is your system in place? You do your critical facilities inspections. A lot of that is done by Metro maintenance personnel. They'll come in and they'll check out critical aspects of the transit system, particularly the rail lines. The Sheriff's Department will also do critical facilities checks, and then they'll look at their capacity to operate. And once they determine where they're at, then we move forward with how they can contribute to help, or what do they need to get back up and running. So those plans are in place. Certainly we can make an appointment and brief you on those particular issues. Okay.
Thank you. In your set of goals, you mentioned public safety, quality of life, visibility, accountability, and Part 1 crimes. Can you explain to me what Part 1 crimes are?
Part 1 crimes are a uniform set of crimes that the FBI measures for all jurisdictions.
Help me out.
I don't think I'll remember all of them off the top of my head, but murder, arson, robbery, theft, auto theft, burglary. And by looking at those different crimes in particular areas, it gives you an idea of the sense of criminality that's going on in a particular community. Now, when we look at it at the sense of criminality that's going on on our particular rail line or on our system. So it's the more serious crimes, and the reason they measure that, it's the more serious crimes that most people are likely to report. They may not report whether somebody is vending on the system, but they will report if somebody stole their iPod. So by using that as a measure, you have a better idea of what's going on in your community, and our community is the transit community.
A couple weeks ago, there was an item that came before this board dealing with elevators and escalators. And I was told that the deputy sheriffs are patrolling the rail system. So my question has to do with, does your department have a protocol for reporting when you see an escalator or an elevator that's inoperable?
Well, the deputies are encouraged to report them to, there's PTELs at every station. They can hit the PTEL and tell the rock, or they can communicate to the desk and let and the desk, and then let the rock know that there's an elevator or escalator out. Now, we can certainly reinforce that with some briefings that that's their obligation and responsibility.
Do you have the ability to turn the
escalators on and off? I don't think you can turn them on and off with a button on the elevators. I don't believe we have that capability right now, no.
Mr. Mitchell, it's like
he's... It actually requires a key, and those have been distributed to some people. Since that board meeting, we've redeployed some light duty personnel trained and with keys to basically supplement what we'd been doing previously with roving personnel. So, I mean, if there was a desire to have the sheriffs do that, I suppose that training and keys could be provided, but you could make the point that they've got other things to do, and the notification should be sufficient to allow us to get somebody out there. I don't have the report in front of me, but we've been getting for a while a daily report and then a weekly report on the experience. And if John Roberts is present, he might be able to give some detail on that later if you'd like it.
The reason I bring that up is I had an experience a few weeks ago, and I brought the experience to this committee. Staff from the Metro statement was that because the elevators and the escalators, several of them were not working. Their answer was that there are a lot of kids out there turning them off. And so I don't know if your deputies have had that particular experience, but I'm just trying to figure out who's seeing what and when does it occur, and how can we make sure that we minimize those systems that are not operating when they should be.
Yeah, I heard the story, and we can certainly encourage our folks to watch out for that, but clearly if a kid's doing it, he's not going to do it when we're standing there. So, but obviously we can keep our eyes out for something like that. That's one of those quality of life issues that make the transit experience problematic. So.
Thank you, Commander Jordan. Appreciate the report. We'll look forward to follow-ups. We do have a request from the public on this item. John Walsh.
John Walsh, United Rail Riders of Los Angeles. Not bus riders, rail riders. HollywoodHighlands.org. We just simply like to say that Commander Jordan is doing a fantastic job. The MTA security is doing a fantastic job. We feel safer and safer on the system, and we demand that you return. We don't want any sheriffs or any security to be, their jobs to be lost. We want more security, not less. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. We now have items 3 through 5, which are all action items on specific contracts. And what I'm going to ask, I think we want to try and hold our quorum, but if there are no questions by members of the committee, if they're willing to move these items, they may do so.
Hold on, I think I have a conflict.
Okay, we're checking to see if we have conflicts on these items. Okay, we'll send 5 over to the full board. I believe there's conflicts, so we can't take action on that item today. Are there conflicts on 3 and 4? We're still checking those. That's it. Okay. Okay, I will move approval of both items 3 and 4. Is there a second? Motion second to approve items 3 and 4. Item 3 is the space planning and installation services and workstations item to McAllister Office Pavilion. Item 4 is the contract with CHP for the Big Rig Service Patrol Program with Metro Freeway Service Patrol. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Items 3 and 4 are approved. Item 5 we said we would send to the full board. Let's move to item, I'm going to ask at this time if we can move up item 8, which is the report from the Citizens Advisory Committee. So we'll do item 8 at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce our Advisory Council, Mr. Neil Bjornson, who is a long-time professional in our business, and we're really fortunate to have Neil as chairing our CAC. Neil?
Thank you, and good morning. In turn, I'd like to introduce to you the Vice Chair of the Citizens Advisory Council, Mr. Gerard Wright. He's kind of my right-hand guy here, and you'll be seeing him from time to time appearing before you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. There are lots of things going on, and we picked a couple of the high spots to discuss today. The first one I will get into is one that we kind of mentioned last time, and it had to do with the question of motor coach color, as there has been some discussion of melding the color for both the local and the rapid operation. And we feel that and endorse that an investigation of the pros and cons of the unification of the motor coach color scheme should be conducted. However, there's a caveat, and that is that even more important than the colors of the equipment, there must be included a study of all marketing aspects of making such a change, because it's going to be major. Actually, the marketing aspect, which includes the pros and cons of the local rapid bus stop unification concept, should be developed as a first step of this process. Once that's settled, then we can get into the color issue. Secondly, in June, there's going to be a shakeup that further reduces the rapid bus concept, which means that more poppy-colored motor coaches will be required on the streets. And we want to impress that sufficient red vehicles are repainted to the poppy color to balance the service type needs without causing confusion in assignment or confusion on the street at the customer level with what we're actually providing out there. This might usurp the four-year paint program a little bit, but we feel it's an important aspect. Moving right along, one item that keeps coming to the floor in our forum is bikes on trains. And I know there's a study that is going to include some policy and perhaps some reconfiguration of seating on some of the, at least the light rail vehicles. We feel that this study should, one, include the large strollers and other wheel devices that are brought aboard. And the CAC affirms the study, policy action, also requests that appropriate enforcement of the here and now on these devices be continued until all rail cars undergo the appropriate modification and are in service. Then we get down to the budget. And I must say this budget document that was recently released is probably the best one I have ever seen. It's simple, it's forthright. It explains in themes what is going on and what is desired, and it was well prepared. As to that budget, we at CAC feel that there are perhaps some enhancements or maybe increased budgetary amounts that could be made available in terms of attention to increased street supervision, particularly on the bus side. That catch up on deferred facilities and equipment maintenance be promulgated at the earliest possible time. It includes the MTA facilities cleanliness, the station cleanliness and operation, grounds cleanliness, and since MTA is now in charge of it, the some cleanup of freeway interchanges in the Los Angeles area. Then a catch-up on deferred maintenance on equipment, which entails rolling stock cleanliness and rolling stock maintenance itself. Now, understood, and I think Mr. Walsh alluded to this a little earlier, that there are certain levels of operability safety that have to be maintained. For example, the California Highway Patrol comes out and inspects buses on a routine basis. Those buses have to be maintained so they're not presenting a physical safety hazard on the street. Same thing with rail cars. So that, I am sure, is being maintained at this point in time. It's the rest of it that needs the catch up. And that's a billion to a $1.5 billion item to get this thing straightened out and then move forward with it with the system in a state of good repair. If we hesitate to do this at this time, that $1 to $1.5 billion is going to balloon, and it's going to cost more to get out of the hole. So we're suggesting that this be taken very seriously and followed through. It translates into what MTA customers see and what they experience, which is reliability and a system they can count on. That concludes my statements for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bjornson. I want to thank you for your continuing service on CAC. Mr. Bjornson is my appointee. I've known him for many years and does a great job here. I want to welcome Mr. Wright as well. He certainly has been extremely interested in transit and look forward to your service as vice chair and ultimately as chair of CAC. And just again, a reminder that Each of us has four appointees. I know I've got some vacancies as well. I think many of my colleagues do as well on the board, that hopefully we can move to get some additional participation to help these gentlemen out on the work that they do. I will ask, I'm going to ask Mr. Taylor if he would be able to bring to this committee a follow-up report in terms of the shop color and how it's affecting the Metro Rapid stops and the integration of the Metro Rapid stops with the service changes, and how we're aligning that service. Yes. And the budget concerns that were brought up today, if you could be prepared to address those at the board meeting. We carried the budget over to that meeting, but if you could address those concerns and points that were made today by CAC. Questions by my colleague, Director Wilson? Okay. We thank you for your report. We appreciate the update.
Thank you, Mr. Fasano.
We'll see you next quarter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's move to item six, which is vehicle emissions for access services and Metro Vanpool fleet.
John Roberts, Interim Executive Director of Transportation. This is a receive and file report to update on our emission, the direction we're going with our access service and Metro Vanpool. The access service in itself does not use currently alternate fuel vehicles, but we have transitioned from cutaways, which are very fuel inefficient, to minivans, which typically get about 16 miles per gallon. Just this week, there was a pilot or a test vehicle called a Mobility Vehicle 1 MV1 that's CNG powered. That it's not production yet, but the access service folks are looking at this. The surprise, typically CNG vehicles of this nature get 100 miles per gallon. This particular one has proven itself about 300 miles, which makes it much more attractive. Access Service continues to work with Clean Energy, looking at their particular division sites and some of the logistical challenges of going to a CNG vehicle. They do have 50 hybrid vehicles that they're using, which is another step in the right direction of going to more fuel efficient. For as far as our Metro Vanpool, these are lease vehicles that lease is coming due in FY12. Typically, the lease is 4 years. Each time they go for lease, they do look for the opportunities to introduce the most current technology. It was looked at as far as converting some of the vehicles to a CNG, and they typically found it was at 60 to 70% of the value of the original vehicle. So it typically has not been a cost, somewhat cost prohibitive to date. They currently run about 1,059 vehicles. Again, next steps are when we go out for a lease again, we'll see what's available. In looking at the available off the market, off the shelf vehicles, more hybrids are becoming available for minivans and the larger vehicles. So 2011, 2013, we should have more options as far as going for a hybrid vehicle. That concludes my update on this report and file.
Questions, Director Wilson?
Mr. Roberts, thank you for the report. Can you tell us in your words or in your view what the biggest impediment will be for us transitioning from the high particulate vehicles to a lower or super low or zero emission vehicle?
For access service, probably the biggest impediment as far as for their staff, they have minimal infrastructure to support that development. That probably be the biggest challenge for the access service folks. They are seeking grants to help them with the CNG option, a version of it. But as far as going for the zero emission, they typically also buy off the state contract. So as those type of vehicles become available under the state contract, that would be the probably the direction that would allow them to go that direction.
When you say infrastructure, are you speaking to fixed infrastructure, or are you talking about the mobile, the vehicles themselves?
Well, for the infrastructure would be the staff. The staff on the access services to help them to reach out, support, research, and help develop that kind of technology. And also, currently they do purchase off the state contract, which as the state contract vehicle or specs move that way, they will have more access or more support to develop that kind of vehicle, zero emission.
Based on what you know, would you say CNG is the technology more so than electric or hybrid form?
Yeah, currently, as of right now, the CNG with this MV1 is the most, that they're looking at right now, as the most readily available.
And I thought I saw your report that the transit folks said that that they had the capacity to retrofit their location for it.
Clean Energy is working with them to make an assessment on their facilities or infrastructure to go with the CNG. Clean Energy is the organization they're working with to work with them on consulting what their infrastructure needs are and their ability to transition to a CNG.
So do they have the capacity, yes or no?
I could not answer it. I have a representative from Access Service here, Mark Maloney, if he could assist on answering that question.
Could you?
Hello, Mark Maloney, Access Services Chief Operating Officer. The quick answer to that is yes, we are contracted with Clean Energy. They have gone out and reviewed all of our existing divisions, and they have found locations and lines enough to be able to implement different variations of CNG at each of our properties. Might be a slow fill, might be a time fill, might be a fast fill, depending on the size of the gas line into that division.
Then CNG is the energy level of the energy, the type of energy you're talking about, more so than a hybrid of gasoline and electric?
Just because of the industry. As Mr. Roberts pointed out, we don't develop vehicles, so it's more of what will the industry. The MV1's coming forward with the CNG. I guess if the moms of the world really pushed and wanted CNG or electric minivans, then Chevy and Ford and Dodge would create that, and then we'd be able to purchase that.
How about the Transit Connect? I know it's a relatively small van that's supposed to be having an electric iteration of that. Is that something that's being looked at for smaller?
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. We did look at that initially, but the loading is rear end, so we can't actually load wheelchairs in the street onto that area. We have to have a side area. But otherwise, yeah, it was a very interesting vehicle for us for a while to look at.
In terms of breakthroughs in the technology, do you expect that it'll happen more with the minivans or with the larger vans first?
I would say larger vans. Larger vans actually, I think, currently have CNG options available. They seem to, because they are more used for plumbing and all these other areas and delivery and such, they seem to be more on the cutting edge than the minivan population is. Not yet, no. And I don't see anything yet on the horizon.
Costs, because I recall when I was on the board back in the 90s, we made a decision at that time to go from methanol and diesel to CNG, and I thought it cost us more money. What is it the variable cost for transitioning from the gas fuel engine to a CNG fuel or any other alternative?
Yeah, the comparison that we have right now would be between what we pay currently off the state contract for a minivan and then for the MV1 and CNG mode. And it looks to be roughly about a $10,000 differential.
Per unit?
Per unit. And of course, then we'd have the expense of the facility improvements to go along with that with CNG. But on the flip side, right now, CNG fuel prices are very attractive. And so that would, you know, offset a good portion of that.
As far as the maintenance cost, is it the same?
We believe so, yes.
Has anyone looked into getting funds or trying to get funds, CMAQ funds and other federal funds, to start out with the aggressive pilot program?
Yes, we have. Actually, I can bring down our government relations but he's got more details. But we actually were in very good shape with an earmark, but then earmarks kind of became not as ready to be handed out. So, but Andre Colise, our government relations person, can address that.
Hello, Mr. Chair, Director Wilson.
Welcome.
Thank you. Back when they were considering reauthorization at the federal level a couple of years ago, there was a call for earmarks, and we submitted a couple projects, and actually Congresswoman Roybal-Allard pushed forward a $4.4 million earmark for us for both CNG infrastructure and CNG vehicles, but given the new climate in Washington regarding earmarks, it's doubtful whether that's actually going to go forward. So we have been trying, but the in terms of the path to getting earmarks have kind of been closed off, so we'll have to maybe go just use the money that's allocated to us to Metro to maybe go forward with this at some point in time. You're welcome.
Okay, I wanted to follow up. You mentioned there was one vehicle that we were looking at that I heard some pretty amazing figures on that. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, actually, it's the MV1, and we actually currently, for I think last week, we have it for 2 weeks. We're actually testing it, not in revenue service, but we're testing as in the mileage range and reliability and how it works out. But yes, it actually is a very unique. It's the first purposely built paratransit vehicle, and it does have spots for two mobility devices in it. It's a good size, gets very good mileage, and right now we're getting 300-mile range on a CNG tank, which was, you know, one of the impediments against the CNG for quite some time. So they seem to be very attractive for our operation.
Very good. Okay, I appreciate the report. It's been very helpful. And I guess one of the things we'd be kind of interested is whether at some point it makes sense to put a bid out with an option that would then really allow us to see more clearly what exactly the premium would be in terms of some of the CNG options. So maybe that's something we could look at down the road. Thank you for the report.
Thank you.
That'll move us to item 7, which is the report on Metrolink ridership and revenue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, our Metrolink analyst, Jay Furman, has a great job of submitting and writing his quarterly report, and he promised that he could make the oral part in 1 minute. So
fabulous.
We're going to time him and see how.
Put on the time. once I say go. Anyways, really quickly here, let's start right now. So for the year, for the first 9 months, the ridership on Metrolink is down about 3%, but that's not really a surprise because of the impacts of the economy. So the ridership is down slightly, but as I'll tell you in a second, that trend is starting to change and it is starting to go up. The revenues are up about 9% for the year, which is very good. That's mostly because they did a fare increase. But nevertheless, the revenues are over budget. This kind of shows just a big picture trend for the last 2 or 3 years on Metrolink ridership. There are big dips in December, which is because the ridership does go down a lot in December. It has been trending down, as I said earlier, because of the economy, but it is ever so slowly bottomed out and starting to trend back up year over year. The next slide is really good because it actually shows you that for the last 26 months consecutive, their year-over-year ridership for the current month was down from the previous year's ridership. So in 2009, it was way down because it was very high in the summer of 2008 due to gas, and the hemorrhaging of the ridership is less than it used to be, but it was still negative year over year due to the unemployment. Now, for the first time ever, it went positive in March, and it's gone positive again in April compared to the previous April. This just shows you the ridership on Metrolink by line. It kind of gives you some perspective. Director Fasana might be interested in this one in particular because you can see how much ridership in particular is on the San Bernardino line. Accounts for about 30% of the ridership. We also do get very heavy ridership on the Orange County and Antelope Valley lines as well. But San Bernardino is very high. We do 20-minute service, and we also just added express services 2 weeks ago on the San Bernardino and the Antelope Valley lines, and the ridership on the San Bernardino Express is doing very well from what we hear. And this final slide shows you the on-time performance for Metrolink. They have a new management structure in place. They're very committed to on-time performance and safety, and they are consistently exceeding their 95% goal. They're up about 97%. And that concludes my presentation. My apologies if I ran over a minute, and I'll be glad to take any questions you may have.
You know, it's outstanding. I'll just ask one question. Are we getting good cooperation from UP right now?
In terms of the interference on the Riverside line, for example. I'll have to get back with on that. I think their on-time performance on all their lines is has been way up, and I think the short answer to your question is yes.
Thank you, Director Wilson.
Thank you.
Appreciate the report. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, that brings us to, you already did item 8. That brings us to item 9, which is the status report on the TAP program and the Fairgate operations.
I'll see if I can even beat a minute. Matt Raymond, Chief Communications Officer, reporting on TAP. We also did a report for the Executive Management Committee meeting this morning. Basically, just to give you an overview on where we are with TAP, we're in the process of converting our Fair Media, which means our corporate conversion of all the paper passes, as well as we've implemented stored value. We've done it at a portion of our retail outlets, as well as at a portion of our ticket vending machines, and we're in the process of working with social service departments to convert them over as well. We've converted a huge portion of our Metro Mail, and also this morning at the EMAC meeting, we brought forward two fair proposals. One is to implement a rolling day, both weekly and monthly pass. One is a 7-day weekly pass, the other is a 30-day rolling pass to replace our calendar-based passes. So that moved forward on committee. And then also we brought forward introducing a reduced $5 day pass as well. And we will be bringing forward next month implementation plans for doing the day pass. And as well, regarding gating, there's been interest in terms of moving forward with testing, locking the gates. And so we will bring back in June a plan on how we will advance locking gates. Our initial plan was looking at trying to lock up to 4 gates by September. We're going to see if we can do different simulations and things like that as early as July. So we're looking at moving into a lock gate environment, and we're analyzing the different options that are out there. In terms of, we've been doing some analysis working with the sheriffs too to identify the impact of simulating the lock gates, and we have seen an increase in both tapping activity as well as TVM activity. It ranges between 40% and 80%. The only part of that I want to note is that when you compare that to things like fare evasion, they're not in conflict with each other, because again, we're increasing a small fraction of our transactions. It's basically rails about 20% of our total ridership, and TVM transactions are about 5% of our total transactions on the system. So it's that 5% that gets impacted when we do these inspections. So we're, another thing too is we are looking at all the different data we're starting to collect on TAP. I know that's been a big interest, and we're just now starting to realize some of the benefits of the gating system in terms of identifying station transactions, exit entry data. It's basically, we can get boarding for rail on specific stations. We can identify the activity. And then lastly, just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the program, last month we reported 14.8 million transactions on TAP, and we kind of project the customers based on the fare media they're using, that about 170,000 customers are on TAP on a monthly basis. And that concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Director Wilson?
Can you tell us when you expect to have a uniformity in terms of a TAP as a fare media throughout our system?
Currently, there are 10 initial TAP members that are at various stages of participation in the program. We recently completed, actually it was in December, we completed our business rules, and then as early as yesterday, we put out information on clearing and settling, which is basically the foundation of a regional system. But that doesn't include all the operators that are out there. We're still working with Metrolink. We're still working with other operators that were within the system. So there isn't a specific time frame that's set up, but we're moving in that direction. I wish I could give you a better answer on a specific date, but
year, 2 years, 3, 4, 5.
Yes, I'd say in terms of having the regional platform set up, we should have that up within a few months, actually. But in terms of as the agencies roll on or enter on and have the equipment installed, that'll be the course of a few years.
Another question. If I have a TAP card, can I load my TAP card as a single fare?
Yes.
Ask you to do that?
Yes. If you have a tap, a plastic tap card, you can pretty much do anything on the system.
I'd like to, Mr. Chair, if you could ask a report at the next meeting that would show us where our vendors are for the ability for our customers to up and load up their tap cards, and if you could segregate them and show me those who are specifically able to also give us weekend access, because I had an experience where that was a problem.
Yes, we'll do that.
The final question has to do with the next generation technologies. Can you tell us a little bit about that and when it will be fully usable from the customer's point of view, where they can take their smartphone or other device, PDA, and have real-time access to when the next bus will be coming down the line, or whether there's no more service that day or not on that line? Can somebody help me?
The system is in operation right now. The technology side of it, the next phase of it will be the implementation of the actual physical side, the stop notification, so that customers can identify which stop they're located at. There'll be unique numbers for stations in our system, and that has not been installed yet. But the technical infrastructure is in place, and the next phase is doing the physical infrastructure. And I don't know, Lonnie, if you had. Okay.
So what's the answer?
If
I were to go and use my smartphone now, I could actually find out when the next bus is going to come?
Yes. Yes. Right now, you have to. It's text driven, or for a smartphone, you would go to a website, the Next Trip website. Go to LA. It's a scrolling down thing, and you would identify the line you're looking for, and then your station location and the direction, and it would tell you the next bus coming. Yes.
Is this widely publicized? Would you say?
No, we're actually right now we're doing basically a soft launch, making sure the system works well. It has been pretty well known in the electronic community. There's been mostly positive comments about the system, and our customers seem to be very receptive to having it available to them. So it's all been positive so far. Thanks.
You know, I have just a few brief comments. You know, Director Wilson asked this question, and you know, in terms of 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, or 5 years, or whatever, and it would seem rather shocking. But I know we've been on this journey for probably close to 10 years, it would seem, and we're still. I think at times we probably almost need a refresher in terms of where it is we're going, and what I would like to see in terms of next steps. I think we're due back with some kind of a timeline or a Gantt chart in terms of what we're trying to accomplish here. What steps off of the original mission we still think are achievable, and what our time frame is, because I think that gives us a better sense of what we need to do with the other operators. I know, I'm a big supporter of not only the Metro service, but the service provided by our municipal partners. At the same time, I thought that one of the benefits of TAP really offered was the idea of a seamless system. I know there have been issues with transfers and paper transfers and how TAP integrates with that, but I would like to really see some of this laid out, and if we have to at some point form a subcommittee with some of the other operators to see what we need to do to move toward the seamless system, I'd like to see it happen, but I also need to see the timeline and what we're doing. I think a Gantt chart, timeline, whatever it is we need to see where we are, what steps are still achievable, and where we may need to reset our objectives would really be helpful. Okay. Director Wilson, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with that. It seems like it's been a long time, and I think it's well overdue. There are lots of folks who have technology skills. Most people carry, at least the people I hang out with, they carry smartphones. And I think it would be great if we had access to a system that could let them know where the train or bus is coming and or whether it's going to come at all. I had one other comment, Mr. Chair. A while back I made a phone call, and maybe I called the wrong number, but I thought it was a Metro number, and it was on a Sunday evening to find out if there was service still being offered on that particular line that I happened to be riding. And I got a recording that said that Metro's closed, we're open on Monday or something like that. So I'm just wondering, is that, maybe did I just use the wrong phone number? Or can a rider who happens to be on the line and waiting, thinking there's more service, and want a call to find out if there's more service or not, and they can't, and they could be sitting there or standing there waiting for an indefinite period of time, thinking that there's a bus that's going to come along, and it's not. We operate where a person can go in, aside from the people who have smartphones, because there are some who still don't, but they do have a phone.
Yes, actually, our operating hours, I think, from like 6:30 to 5:30. I think it's like all 7 days a week. But the biggest advance we've made there is 511, which is an automated system that works 24 hours a day. So even when we don't have live personnel there, you can dial 511. There's two numbers, basically. There's 323 Go Metro, and if that's not where you can, and 511 will both get you to the same place. And that gives you 24-hour automated assistance on your phone. So whether it's a landline or a cell phone.
Known that I could call 511, I could have found out about that, the fact that there was no service on that line for the remainder of that evening?
Yes.
I'm on the board, I just got back, but how many people do you think really know that there's a 511?
It's 511 was launched over a year ago, and I know they do periodic campaigns. What do you want to comment?
Al Martinez with operations. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to make sure that I was clear with regards to the response, with regards to if a public came in either on the phone or on the web or on a smartphone and wanted to find out if there was another vehicle available and if there was no vehicle available. And what we've implemented in order to try and to reduce some of that confusion is to provide a response that would allow an operator that or a rider that would know that there was no current prediction. And when we say no current prediction would indicate that there was no vehicle coming for that whatever stop that person was at.
Are you saying that I could have called on the phone and found that out?
Yes, if you're using the 511 on the IVR, yes, you'd get something. And it would actually prompt you and say, and you would be forwarded to a caller.
I recall calling the Metro line, a Go Commuter, I can't recall the exact number, but I remember calling that number and I got a voicemail recording that said we're open, we're closed at 5:30, and this was certainly way after 5:30 that I happened to be riding. So what should I have done?
Oh, call the 511 number would give you 24-hour service.
That's really replaced the 800 commute number as the primary access point for that information.
Yes. Well, actually, yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm just not. I don't ride the bus all the time. Maybe the people who do know that there's a 511 out there.
Mr. Wilson, there has been an extensive public information campaign, including billboards around the city, notifying people that 511 is traveler information. Now, whether people who are driving around seeing a billboard or riding around seeing a billboard connect 511 with bus information is a step that we ought to be looking at. But that's good.
Well, my particular experience was I was riding with someone who rides the bus all the time, and They didn't tell me 511 because we were both stranded. It was like 9:45, waiting for a bus to come that didn't, because we didn't know. So I'm just wondering how effective our marketing really was, because I don't know the answer. I'm just asking the question.
Away from your experiences, it certainly is not completely effective, and 511 is like 411 and
911
and 311, and it takes time for those things to seep into the popular awareness. I think Matt will take that.
I think it would be helpful. I don't know how people get that information, but certainly those who ride the bus all the time, if you had something on the bus that said 511, you know, if you don't know if a bus is coming or not, you know, take one of the little handouts, because you have a little sheet that shows the line and the service and all that. But
yeah, it is on all of our timetables and everything as well, too. So, but we will look into improving the communications on that. And we also will provide a timeline that you requested at the next meeting.
Thank you. Appreciate the update and the response to the questions. We do have a request from the public to address the committee on this item. Mr. Walsh.
Mr.
John Walsh, HollywoodHighlands.org. Last week, 55,000 successful server requests in 7 days, 750,000 in the last month. I have the analytics here for anyone who doesn't believe it. TAP is a tower of Babel. You promised us, Art Leahy 2 years ago promised within a month of the gates being put up, they would be locked. Then he changed his mind. You have to prove to Homeland Security when you lock those gates that it is not terrorist friendly and that people can escape in case of a terrorist incident. That's why you're not locking the gates. Everybody knows that, and it's been leaked to me. HollywoodHighlands.org. And this 511, Mayor Mel, I'm telling you, everybody knows about it. I don't know what planet you live on. I take the bus all the time. They've done an excellent job, the staff, in this very expensive media campaign on 511.
Mr. Walsh, I'd just like to clarify that the CEO does not have a report on item 10. You've requested to address the committee under public comments, so you are back up.
You can all go home.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. And with no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.